am Reese Tisdale, and this is Future Water, which we talk about all the ways which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, we're celebrating episode number 53 of the Future Water. As one of our first interns used to say, celebrate your victories. So it's a good policy, I'm not going to lie. So shout out to Chris Jackson from years past. He was one of our first interns, did an incredible job, worked on one of our first consulting projects. In addition to that, what I'd also like to add is a couple of points of news to share with you. If you're interested in digital water, Bluefield's global forecast across 45 countries is quite honestly, it's selling like hotcakes. You should get in on the action. If you're interested to learn more about the size, growth trends, and factors shaping 34 segments in the water sector, really detailed analysis and lots of data to go with it. Another report we just put out a couple months ago, but then we've subsequently put out some additional research to backfill some changes that have been happening recently in regards to health advisory levels. PFAS is in the news again, so brush up on all the factors, market drivers, policies, players, forecasts, and then some from our recent report. Lauren Balsamo has done a really good job of keeping pace with that market and understanding what's happening there. And also, it might be worth noting that, you know, recent rulings by the Supreme Court could, in the long term, have some impact on things like MCLs that might be coming down the pipe in 23, 24. Lastly, we also just released some analysis on hydrogen markets and the opportunities for the water sector. So this includes everybody from green super majors, that'd be the renewable IPPs is another way to put it, as well as the traditional oil and gas players like Shell and BP that are active in that market. The pipeline is looking really big, particularly in Europe. There's going to be water demand for all of this hydrogen, whether it comes from groundwater sources and treated or whether it comes from surface water potentially or even municipal water. There are opportunities out there for the water sector to play a key role. And in some cases, maybe some of these energy players will also play a key role in bridging that gap between electric power generation and water. We're already seeing some activity there. So Colin O'Brien, our colleague, has put out that analysis. Really interesting. So keep that in mind. So these are just a couple thoughts that I thought I'd share with everybody. To learn more about all of this, visit our website at bluefieldresearch.com. You can listen to our podcast, that is Future Water, which you're listening to right now. Subscribe. And then also that might be of value to you and your colleagues and friends is our weekly Waterline newsletter, which comes out every Wednesday, provides, I think, three news items, some updates on data, updates on our new report. Sometimes there's free things out there. If you go to our website, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, we let everybody know that we did some analysis on water rates, water and wastewater rates across 50 to 60 utilities in the U.S. that we benchmark every year. So that is free. If you go to our website, you can download that. So if you are interested, give it a shot. So without further ado, let's bring in my colleagues, Chloe Meyer and Colin O'Brien, who are going to talk a little bit about global water and what's happening there. This should be interesting. There's a lot happening. It's also a lot of ground to cover. So look forward to a conversation with them. All right. So I'm joined here by Chloe Meyer and Colin O'Brien. We're all in different parts of the world right now. So why don't we start with you, Chloe? It seems like the world is on fire. So what's going on with you? Where are you?
Hi, Reese. Hi, Colin. Hi, everyone. I'm in Brittany at the moment, in the western part of France. It's pretty hot, but temperatures have been cooling down. So it's getting better.
All right. Well, hopefully just by the end of the week. I think everybody's saying that, but I'm not going to lie. In Boston, I looked and saw that the temperatures are not going to go down anytime soon. It seems like next week it's going to be hot. Colin, what about you? What's your 20, as they say, on the road?
Hey, thanks for having me. Hello, Chloe. Hello, Reese. I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin right now, so pretty far up north, at least in North America. Unseasonably hot in the 80s here. Luckily, I live near the lake, though, so getting some cool wind, I guess, from the east. So not too bad, but unseasonably hot for sure.
So we've talked a little bit about this, Colin, and actually no one on the Future Water's heard your voice before. So welcome. but I guess Milwaukee. So one of the things we've talked about in the past, you're just up the road, down the road from the mysterious Foxconn plant, right?
Yeah, north. I think that's down in Racine County. So just the county below me.
Okay. Yeah, because that was a big, I remember our colleague Keith Hayes was really excited about that one point about this huge Foxconn plant being built in Wisconsin. And there was going to be all this water demand and all these new water strategies. But it turns out it seems to be a bit of a mirage. Does everybody in Milwaukee or Racine feel the same way about it?
Yeah, definitely. I think it kind of seems like a ploy that ended up wasting a lot of tax dollars, honestly.
Well, you know, that's par for the course, I suppose, to be a little cynical. So that being said, so back to you, Chloe. I mean, like we started out, I mean, the world is on fire, as hot as Hades out there. You're in Europe. We've just released about to release a quarterly insight on the global water markets and trends. One of the key takeaways, at least from that report that I saw, is the climate and what's happening in Europe. So what's the story when it comes to that in Europe?
Right. So absolutely. The last few weeks in Europe have seen exceptional temperatures. Actually, in France and the UK, several temperature records have been broken, whether historic or daily records. And there are still many wildfires going on in Portugal, in Spain, and in France as well because of the heat. It's interesting to note that the story around droughts and heat this year has been going on for a few months now. It started this winter. We had a very dry winter in the entire Mediterranean region. And I think it's something we actually reported about in our previous quarterly review that went out this spring. We saw that countries were already implementing measures to limit drought and water deficits. I recall that in February, for instance, Portugal already reduced hydroelectric dams production to prevent the dry up of reservoirs. And Italy also implemented water rationing measures this winter, including things like switching off taps at night or preventing the water gardening, for instance. And that was in the middle of winter, right? And it just continued over the spring. The Alps only got half of their seasonal snowfall and nearly 4 months without rainfall, any rainfall at all. And for the past few weeks, as you were saying, most of Europe has been experiencing really high temperatures along with continued droughts.
So as horrible as this is, I mean, there are clearly impacts on the water sector, and I could argue for good and bad, right? Obviously, people don't have water. So why don't you, any thoughts on what those impacts are in particular?
Right. So let's start with bad impacts, if I can say. So in Italy, we're seeing the Po, which is the longest river, that is really drying up, and the country has actually declared a state of emergency in the northern region. And incidentally, it's the region that produces nearly a third of Italy's food, including by irrigating crops with water from the rivers. The forecast here is really pessimistic when it comes to the agricultural production and industry in general this year. We're seeing impacts also in other parts of Europe, like in Romania, for instance, where the water levels in reservoirs are quickly decreasing. This obviously poses issues for the supply of both populations, but also activities, whether they are, again, agriculture, but also industrial manufacturing, right? And we could see really in the near future some water shortages and rationing measures being implemented there. And finally, in France, the droughts are threatening the power production. The nuclear reactors, which account for 70% of the power production here, are forbidden usually from discharging cooling water that is too hot in rivers in order to limit impacts on the environment. And that means reducing or even stopping power production for a while when temperatures are too high. However, the drought that is happening right now in France is colliding with the fact that nearly half of the French reactors are not working at the moment because of auditing and different maintenance issues. So we both have a drought and a low power production capacity at the moment. And some nuclear reactors have just been exceptionally allowed to discharge cooling water at temperatures above the regulatory threshold to ensure that we keep some power production on despite the heat wave. So a lot of lots of problems, of course, but also on a more positive note, lots of opportunities for investors on the water side, particularly looking at unconventional water resources, water reuse, desalination, and overall more water efficiency in industrial processes. I recall earlier this year, Belgium, for instance, started its first desalination project, which is quite unusual for a country such up north in Europe, but it's a signal that the market is opening up in Europe as well for such solutions for unconventional water resources.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, if I recall, you know, definitely California is a good example. Obviously, I'm in the U.S., so looking at the last drought, the big, you know, probably the same drought when it's all said and done, historically speaking, in the rearview mirror. But there was a big drought. They had the conservation measures or mandates put in place. The reuse project pipeline for municipal utilities just soared, you know. And I think even now, Bluefield, we're tracking 600, 700 municipal reuse projects, you know, in that sector alone. That doesn't even include what's happening on the industrial side. So your mention of things like, what is EDF doing with the power plants and power production? They're having to seek exceptions to discharge water, higher temperature water. It just puts the spotlight on water as a whole and the threats to that sector, but also drives innovation, efficiencies, and other technologies and solutions. So yeah, I agree with you there. So not to be a downer, but if you're in the water sector, there's an opportunity. So, Colin, I mean, the situation is really not just in Europe. What else is happening elsewhere?
Yeah, not to pile on here, but unfortunately, the situation is similar globally. You see unusually hot temperatures and droughts that are affecting countries from South Asia, Iraq, to Mexico, particularly the agricultural output, similar to in Italy with the Po River drying up. So for instance, India, which is the second largest producer of wheat globally, they banned wheat exports due to heat waves and water shortages. And similarly, in Pakistan, which is the fifth largest mango producer, they're expecting a 50% drop in mango production this year, like India is, due to just extreme heat in the region and corresponding water shortages. Unfortunately, again, it's not just South Asia that's being affected. You have Iraq and Mexico that are also struggling to meet either agricultural or municipal water requirements. So in Iraq, the government officials cut irrigation for agricultural purposes by 50% just to conserve water. So as a result, like India, wheat production is expected to decline as much as 60% just this year. In Baja, Mexico, this is more on the municipal side, they're likely going to have to buy water from farmers in the agricultural region of Mexicali if household productions aren't reduced by about 20%. So the United States and Mexico has an agreement. It's called Minute 323. It's about how water is shared from the Colorado River. And under the agreement, Mexico can lose up to 18% of its Colorado River quota if Lake Mead falls below 1,025 feet above sea level. And currently the level's at 1,043 feet above sea level. So if you have another 18-foot drop, Mexico will pretty much be forced to implement municipal water restrictions because of water shortages. And so I think the larger story here is that prolonged droughts are going to be affecting water consumption for municipalities, but also agricultural and power sectors.
I want to interrupt there for a second, because one of the amazing things you got me at was Pakistan is the fifth largest mango producer in the world. So who knew? That's a good factoid. But sorry to interrupt. What else is going on in the world?
Well, I kind of think talking about droughts, it almost seems like beating a dead horse at this point. It comes up in almost every conversation when you talk about water. But I think it's particularly in this quarter, it's important to note that there is new data suggesting that it's getting worse. So no shortage of bad news. In May, the United Nations had a report. It was called Drought Numbers 2022. And it found that since 2000, the number and duration of droughts has risen 29%, which obviously is not good. So given that new information, droughts are likely to continue and worsen globally, pretty much. And in the context of the water sector, I'd agree with Chloe that water reuse and water efficiency measures will need to begin now on a country-by-country level. And I'd also add that I think significant increases in desalination, like in Belgium, can be expected in the near future, given the worsening conditions.
Yeah, I mean, I guess on a personal level, maybe to both of you, I'm just curious, does it feel worse to you than it has in the past? Or is this just the media cycle that is in our face every 10 minutes or every day? What do you think? Think it's worse, Chloe?
I think it's worse. Yeah, I remember when I was a kid going into the car and seeing the temperature monitor at 30 degrees Celsius were exceptional, and now it's a regular thing that happens nearly daily during the summertime. And I do recall that it was exceptional when I was a kid, which was not so long ago.
What's amazing is the fact that you, when you were a kid, you could go into the car and there was a thermometer in the car. That makes me feel old, because when I was a kid, that didn't happen. There was no such thing. Colin, what about you?
Yeah, I think just anecdotally, I would agree with Chloe that it's getting worse. It's hard to acknowledge because I feel like on the news, talk of drought and gloom and doom is repeated ad nauseum. So, you know, you kind of become numb to it, but definitely anecdotally, I can say that it feels a lot hotter even here. I don't remember many days in the 90s in Wisconsin, and we're definitely getting more of them.
I mean, it's really amazing that, as they say, you know, you sort of feel like a frog in a boiling pot of water. You know, it's just getting hotter and hotter. You don't really realize it's happening. So, well, with that being said, let's, aside from our personal concerns or feelings on what's happening temperature-wise to us, what about, what's the link to, or like when we look at EU policies, right? So let's look back at the EU. What can we expect in terms of water sector investment as a whole? I mean, do we see any relationship to not these necessary immediate droughts, but climate as a whole? What do you think?
Yeah. So as you probably know, the EU has set ambitious goals of being carbon neutral by 2050. And this is pretty much going to be done through the so-called Green New Deal, which is a set of economic and social reforms to address development and climate change. So right now there's midway targets to more than half carbon emissions by 2030 compared to the 1990 levels. And this is being done mostly through renovation of buildings to improve energy efficiency, but also investing in renewables in order for them to cover 40% of energy consumption by 2030. So interestingly, obviously, that can't happen in a vacuum. So a lot of these objectives are colliding with geopolitical turmoil. So the Russia-Ukraine conflict is probably the most obvious one and kind of shed light on the dependency of Europe on foreign energy, obviously with Russian gas. So EU policymakers are trying to increase energy security and accelerate the transition toward carbon neutrality at the same time as dealing with geopolitical events. And so it's kind of a hard line to walk.
I mean, one of the challenges in the water sector is, you know, there's the water sector itself and the water sector's demands, even the water sector's even own carbon footprint. But there are all these other externalities, which I think is really what you're getting at, is like, what's the impact of Russia, Ukraine, energy prices? That influences what happens in the water sector in the discussion, because the water sector requires energy, operating costs, and so on. Drought, as we already talked about, that's related to climate. So there are all these factors, and it's really kind of hard to put your finger on. But when you talk about the EU policies, Colin, how does that link with the water industry itself? Can you draw any connections where there might be opportunities?
Yeah, I think we'll see water demands change across industrial and power sectors, and municipal utilities are likely to focus on their own emissions through energy capture and efficiency improvements. This will also include biogas generation from wastewater treatment processes, for instance, but also more investment in green hydrogen projects. There's potentially more than 40 gigawatts of green hydrogen by 2030 in the EU, which will obviously have opportunities for water supplies, treatment, innovative management strategies. But I guess in all of these cases, more advanced water management strategies and treatment will be required to support wastewater reuse, water for hydrogen, or commercial water management.
Yeah, as you know, I'm really excited about the hydrogen sector. One, having come from renewables and understanding sort of the impact of storage, but also just overall power demand. You just put some research out on that specifically, but one of the takeaways or one of the, if to paraphrase one of your sentences, is, you know, lost in the enthusiasm of the green hydrogen economy is water, right? No one's really seems to be thinking about that, but it is the raw material input into electrolysis and hydrogen production. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds between not only the green super majors, as well as the traditional oil and gas super majors like the Shell and BPs of the world, but also the Iberdrolas and the NextEras on the green side of the equation. So, well, given all this uncertainty and not to, you know, see if we can get out of the feeling of being downers here. It's interesting, Chloe, to see that there was an IPO in the water sector. De Nora, I think the Italian-based company, went ahead with an IPO amidst all this craziness. I mean, we may be heading into a recession. The world is collapsing before our eyes. We're burning up. What's your take on the IPO and just the market as a whole?
Right. So De Nora is an Italian company, as you were saying, that specializes in the production of electrodes for different devices like rechargeable batteries, but also water treatment systems. And they do also develop products for green hydrogen applications. And at the end of the month of June, they raised nearly $500 million with an initial public offering on Milan's stock exchange in Italy. And it's interesting for different reasons. First, De Nora has actually been doing quite well for the past few years. In 2021, the revenues of the water division grew by over 20%, with EBITDA up more than 100%. The margin also more than doubled between 2019 and 2021, reaching 15% last year. And that's what brought several US and European energy transition investors to buy in the IPO, betting on future booming growth from hydrogen generation capacity investments, as we were discussing earlier. Secondly, Nora's listing was the first IPO in Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. The listing have been slowing down dramatically this year, with an increasing number of issues pulling deals as recession fears grow, as you're mentioning. And with inflation and rising interest rates, it's been a real tailspin for stock markets. Valuations have been plunging, and that obviously makes IPOs a difficult sell. And this is quite what happened with to De Nora. The group's entry on the public stock exchange was rather disappointing, with a total market value shy of $3 billion, while the projected valuation was over $5 billion.
Yeah, I mean, I would say putting a positive spin on that is, you know, given all the turmoil, the water focus, I mean, that really helps, like whether it be industrial, municipal, or ESG as a whole, that, you know, water treatment, water management will become even more valuable over time. And I think that was sort of that is the card they're playing. They obviously needed the capital, or at least used the IPO as a tool to raise capital and grow. But I think the long-term play here, if managed well, is positive. Does that say anything? I mean, what's your take on sort of the market landscape for companies as a whole?
So the situation is definitely quite difficult at the moment. We have high energy prices, a prolonged supply chain disruption that are continuing to feed inflation. And we've seen actually in the recent months, a lot of central banks around the world, whether in the US, in Japan, in the Eurozone, also in Canada, that have been increasing interest rates to try to curb spending. And in Europe, several indicators, including looking at manufacturing and construction, have been contracting for the past few weeks. So clearly pressure is still high on new orders, inventory levels, production, supply deliveries, but also employment. And we'll definitely be watching this space as publicly traded companies will release their Q2 results in the next few weeks. But we expect more of a contraction of the market, balancing high activity and strong results that have generally been reported in Q1. Although, of course, some companies have been managing to seize opportunities during those sort of troubled times. And I think it's the case of Suez, right, Colin?
Yeah, so we'd actually be remiss if we didn't mention some good news, and that comes from Suez, who successfully issued its first green bond in May, despite the pretty challenging market conditions and heightened volatility, particularly in relation to kind of a series of economic and geopolitical events. So central banks tapering announcements, rising inflation globally, new lockdown measures in China, and also the war in Ukraine. So Suez ultimately attracted a combined order book of 7.5 billion euros, which was from over 200 institutional investors, and that represented an offering that was 2.9 times oversubscribed. So the transaction ended up, I think it was 2.5 billion in total, but that's unprecedented in terms of size for the water and waste utility sector. And it's the second largest green bond in 2022 period. So that's a pretty big deal. And I think it illustrates the market's confidence in Suez's credit and sustainability profile after the Veolia acquisition had been finalized earlier this year.
Yeah, and I know we've been looking more closely at that deal as a whole. I think what's interesting is I'm a big believer that Suez, even though its footprint has shrunk, and actually it's really, I think 60% or so, you know, approximately, are in France. Even globally speaking, Suez still has a significant brand recognition that I think it'll play in its favor in the long run. And then, you know, why at the same time, you know, not to get into that deal, but Veolia will have its own challenges just in managing its own scale. That's going to be hard enough as it is. But yeah, I think that's really interesting. So, well, thinking about, you know, water supply sort of jumping around the globe a little bit, our colleague Isabel Kesman, she just recently evaluated global desal markets and what's happening in that space, you know, particularly ownership. The quarterly report that you guys just worked on touches on some of this activity around the world. So, and I'm not going to lie, when I saw the draft of this come across my desk, there was a lot more desal activity announcements than I anticipated. So what's the story there?
Yeah, Q2's had a lot of movement in desalination, some where you'd expect, some not where you'd expect. And so there's a lot of new announcements for new projects, but also there was announcements that there was completions of large scale desalination plants. Geographically, the most activity, at least in Q2, was in Saudi Arabia, but the kind of outliers were Senegal and Oman, who had significant announcements of new desalination projects. So I guess to start with the big one, Saudi Arabia, there's multiple projects in the pipeline and a bunch coming to completion. So the total is about US $700 million for all these projects in Saudi Arabia. But the largest operational desal plants that were announced were in Jubail and the Jizan regions, which provide a total of over a million, or approximately a million meters cubed a day, to a population of roughly 5 million people. And in the pipeline, also in Saudi Arabia, they have a 570 meter cube per day desalination plant being planned to provide potable water to 2 million people in or around Riyadh. This is kind of a side note, but important for Saudi Arabia. They announced that it'll transfer the assets of its main desalination company to Water Solutions Company. Water Solutions Company is owned by the Public Investment Fund, Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund, which is quite large. It's $620 billion in estimated assets. And the Saline Water Conversion Corporation will remain a government agency. The Water Solutions Company could pursue an IPO.
And I would add to that, just for those who don't know, SWCC, Saline Water Conversion Corporation, it's the largest desal owner in the world. So they have significant capacity by a long shot. And the pipe, and you include the pipeline, it is Saudi Arabia. They've invested heavily in the desal. So sorry to interrupt.
No worries. I think for the less conventional, the less expected desal projects, Senegal is moving forward with desalination. It awarded its first ever desalination plant contract in June of this year. And it was valued at $153 million. And the Indian company Viatech Wabag will be responsible for engineering procurement, as well as management of the facility, which I believe is part of Senegal's strategy to make drinking water universally accessible by 2035. So that's pretty aggressive. So I guess generally it's interesting to see that desalination is growing both as continuous operations and historic water scarce markets like the Middle East, but also new geographies where developing countries are increasingly turning to unconventional water sources to achieve their targets for universal access to water. And I guess broadly speaking, the effects of climate change, population growth, and the rise of industrialization will continue to pressure water sources and force countries to tap into new water resources and pursue new projects in desalination.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, the Middle East is obviously the hot spot for all the activity, but you know, one would expect to see at least a bit more in places like Spain, maybe even France. But I mean, you guys already mentioned Belgium, right? Who would have thought when they announced that? One would definitely think you'd see more in places like California, but that's been completely shot down by regulatory agencies, you know, when it comes to one, environmental impact, but also the cost of water. So desal is the most expensive water out there, but it's an insurance policy. And I think Australia, at least cities in Australia, are learning that as well. That being said, I mean, we're certain to see reuse, whether it be on the municipal side, elsewhere in places like Europe, and even the Middle East, quite honestly. I know in the past, we've looked at reuse in the Middle East, and that pipeline was growing, reclaiming wastewater for alternative uses. So this is the upside of all this catastrophe and drought and focus on water is exactly that. It gets people to kind of get off their behinds and start doing things. I think there's some expectation that water is always going to flow out of the tap or, you know, be there as needed, but doesn't seem that's always the case, as we're learning a bit of the hard way. So that being said, so why don't we just circle back a little bit, Chloe, what's, you know, before we jump, what are you working on these days? Anything of note?
Yes, we are doing a lot of custom research at the moment, looking at the industrial sector, in particular looking at the outsource of operation and management of industrial water and wastewater treatment services. And I think it's an interesting time as, again, we have inflation, increasing prices. It's an interesting time for investors looking to tap into operation and management of those industrial systems as the manufacturers are looking at decreasing OPEX costs of current existing facilities, but also decreasing potentially CAPEX cost of new facilities. So lots of research going on around this topic.
Nice. So Colin, what about you? What's going on in your world as far as research goes? What are you working on these days?
I've got two things going. One is Veolia and Suez, how that all shook out. Earlier this year, they officially split. So basically seeing what their new footprints are in water and what that means for the water sector broadly, if there's new opportunities for other companies like I believe Sauer is one that has benefited from the merger. And then I'm also looking at EU gigafactories and trying to figure out what the impact on water will be, because just in the last year, you've had dozens of announcements, particularly in Europe, for new gigafactories coming online before 2030.
And what's crazy when you look at that list, we're not just talking about Tesla here. I mean, it's so many other companies, obviously, and maybe Chloe, you could speak to this in Europe, but in the US, everybody seems to just talk about Tesla for a lot of reasons, right? The loudest voice in the room is Elon Musk, it seems, but maybe he'll get knocked down soon enough. But so what's happening in that space? I mean, it really gets back to the energy transition, which is, energy transition includes transportation as well. So switching from fossil fuels over to electric vehicles. And there's, a long thread that ties into the power sector and lots of other, including mining in the supply chain. But to see what happens in that space will be really interesting. So, all right. Well, if there's nothing else to add in global water, there's a lot happening here. So thanks for your time and sharing some of that. There is a global quarterly, which I anticipate it'll be released out to clients, if not today, probably later this week. And definitely by the time this podcast hits the street. So Colin, Chloe, thanks a million for your time. And until we talk again, stay cool.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
All right, there you have it. So thanks to Colin and Chloe for participating in the podcast. Lots of information out there. And, I promise in the office, we're not so pessimistic. It's just hard not to be these days. But that being said, before we sign off, please subscribe to the Future Water Podcast and give us a review. Send us a note at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com with any topic ideas you would like us to discuss. We're doing this for you. It's not about us. And lastly, tell a friend about it. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com to learn more. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and take care.